after recording myself. But I will talk some a little bit about designing games as well. But I wanted to leave myself time in the middle of the day to be able to talk to the publishers and so on and so forth. So we have 2 hours here, and then I've got some time, and then 2 hours at 3 o'clock. How many people here have designed a game to the point where other people could play? How many have had a game actually published? How many would like to have a game published? How many aren't sure why they're here? That's all right, too. Some people are not sure about why they're there all the time.
Thank you.
Especially kids. My name is Lou Pulsifer. I've designed my own game since I was, God knows, a teenager, let's say, actually probably earlier than that. And I find that many of the people who do design games have designed games all their lives. It's like a lot of people who write novels have been writing all their lives since they learned how to write. You don't necessarily do it because you think you're going to make money. You do it because you have to, because you want to. Nonetheless, there are people who write novels who just came to it very late in life and had never done it before, and I'm sure there are people who design games who came to it later in life and had never designed games, and they just turn out to be good at it. So that shouldn't put you off. I began playing war games, commercial war games, in 1963, so you can guess how old I am. I've had 6 games published commercially, but by far the most well-known is Britannia. Anybody here ever play Britannia? See, even a game that's relatively well-known, when you get with a group of people, most of them won't have played it. Now, if you say Settlers of Catan, how many people have played Settlers of Catan? But that isn't an extraordinary game. That one is published in the millions, as opposed to the tens of thousands. My main job nowadays is teaching video game design to college students. But before that, I taught computer networking and things like that. And before that, I worked as a computer person in an Army Medical Center. So I, but my PhD is in military history. I just never pursued that. Now we're going to have a reality check. How many people think you can make a living designing games? Now you're all suspicious. A few people can, but it's very rare. And most of the people who do work for a game company full-time. They're not freelancers. So Hasbro, for example, has people who design games. Rob Daviau, I don't know if I pronounce that right, for example. And that's what they do. But how many people are there like that? Very few. Even in the video game industry, most of the people who make a living designing games are working for a company full-time. Nonetheless, last year, one of the guests of honor, Matt Forbeck, volunteered to come to my version of the seminar last year and help out. He does make a living full-time. However, that's not designing board games. He mostly writes RPG stuff, and he's also written 11 novels. He came to games from the creative writing side. That's what he majored in college, was creative writing. But he earns enough to feed a family of 7. He had quadruplets. But that's the exception. The rule is, if you do design a game and you get it published, you might make a little bit of money, but if you keep track of all your expenses of coming to conventions as business expenses and so on, you'll find out that you're not making any money. In fact, some people would say that you could make more money going out and spending the same amount of time picking up bottles and cans and turning them in for deposits and for recycling. So that's reality. How many of you ever heard of Alan R. Moon? He designed Elfinlands and recently Ticket to Ride and quite a few other games, a lot of games over many years. Oddly enough, he was a playtester for the American version of Britannia. He's reformed himself. Now he's not a wargamer anymore. Despite all that, despite all his experience and all the games he's had published, he told me that he would have had to get a part-time job if Ticket to Ride had not won the Game of the Year in Germany. Now, once Ticket to Ride won the Game of the Year, he said he figured at least 250,000 copies would be sold, and I suspect it's more than that, considering there are the spin-offs and so on. And he probably made a dollar or more off of each game, so we're talking real money there. But that's the exception, very much the exception. So if you're going to design games, it should be because you like to design games and because you like to have things happen like happened to me yesterday. I was sitting talking to Steve Rawlings, who publishes Against the Odds magazine, and a guy I'd never met, as far as I know, walked up and looked at my thing and said, "I really like Britannia. Thank you for getting it back in print," and shook my hand and walked away. That's cool. Or if somebody asks you to autograph a game, that's cool. But it's not a living. It's just cool. So keep those two things in mind. Most people who write novels have full-time jobs. Most of the people who publish games have full-time jobs. You guys all know who GMT is? Most of you publish a hell of a lot of games. The principal guys there have full-time jobs. Andy Lewis, for example, who's their game acquisitions guy, is an engineer. And he says, you know, "I'm never going to make money at publishing the way I can as an engineer." So he's an engineer, and he's got kids, and he's the president of a little league, and he does this other stuff as well. How many people have ever heard of Glenn Cook, the fantasy writer? He wrote the Black Company series and the Private Investigator series and so on. He worked full-time for General Motors and never gave up that full-time job. He's retired now. He wrote his novels while he commuted. And when he changed his commute, he went from several novels a year to one a year. But he never gave up that full-time job. Now he's retired. He's turning out about two novels a year. So it tends to be a part-time job, not a full-time job. Most publishers don't make much money, like I said. Most publishers of most kinds of games started their company to publish their own stuff. Probably most of you have heard of Fantasy Flight Games. Fantasy Flight Games started as a comic distribution company. When that didn't work out, they published a game designed by the owner of the company, and that kept them from going bankrupt. And most of the games they publish now are games that are designed in-house. They published Britannia because the owner of the company liked Britannia, and he's the owner of the company. He can do what he wants. He's making money. I tried to talk him out of it and failed, fortunately, because I looked at their catalog and there were no historical games in it. I said, "Why do you guys want to publish a historical game?" "Because I like it." He talked me into it. And that's worked out very well. But that's the kind of thing you're going to run into, that a lot of publishing companies aren't actually interested in freelance contributions because of the origin of the company. And many companies are very small. How many of you know of Z-Man Games? One guy. There's one full-time employee, Zev, the owner. Clash of Arms, one full-time guy. Now, Fantasy Flight's different. Fantasy Flight makes like $8 million in revenue a year, and they have a couple dozen employees, but that's very much the exception. Now, Hasbro, you're talking huge, and you know that's a different kettle of fish, but there's only one company like that in this country. And they own Parker Brothers and Milton Bradley and Avalon Hill, and all the old-time big companies have all been bought up by Hasbro, including Wizards of the Coast. In comparison, video games are much, much a bigger deal. There's a lot more money there. There's a lot bigger market. I mean, some of you guys are older, remember when war games were much more prevalent than they are now. And they used to sell tens of thousands of copies. And now, with few exceptions, they sell 1,000 or 2,000 copies. And some people think there's been a great expansion of gaming because they see all the Euro games around. Most Euro games don't sell more than 10,000 copies unless they win a prize or unless they're very unusual. the reason Euro games can exist is in Germany, playing games with your family is a tradition. And so people are much more likely to play board games in Germany. And Euro games essentially are family games on steroids. There are exceptions like Puerto Rico, which I don't call a Euro game, but a lot of people do. But most of them are games that have a lot more brain input than the typical American game. But they still have the opportunity for Junior to manage to win occasionally by some stroke of fortune or some good move. And that's why I call them family games on steroids. Those are the popular games. If you want to make games that might sell a lot, then you want to do a Euro-style game. But if you don't like Euro-style games, and I don't particularly, then trying to design one is probably a bad idea. You certainly don't want to design games just for yourself. You want to design games that other people enjoy. But if you try to design something that's foreign to you, you're probably not going to succeed. It's probably going to be a bad game. So how many people here would say they are Euro gamers? How many would say they are war gamers? Some people don't seem to say one thing or another. Okay, that's all right. Some people are just gamers. They just play all kinds of games. Now, there are various misconceptions that I run into both in students and in places like board game design forums. You get somebody who has an idea. They think it's the greatest idea ever. They think it's wonderful and stupendous. And they think because they have this idea, they have themselves a game. They don't have squat. Nobody buys an idea. And of course, you can find exceptions. But in general, nobody buys an idea. They want a complete game. Moreover, there are no new ideas, with very, very few exceptions. So that great idea that you have has probably been a great idea that dozens of other people have had. And it's unique to you, and you think it's stupendous, and you tell that to a publisher, and they just yawn. Because they've heard it before. And because they've run into people who are fanboys and they think they have this great idea, they don't want to know. It's a waste of their time. In fact, they're a little bit afraid of it. What they're afraid of is somebody's going to tell them this great idea, quote unquote, and then the publisher's already working on a game that uses that idea, and when the publisher publishes the game, they're going to get sued. That's what they're worried about. That's why many publishers require you to sign a form before you submit any material to them that essentially says they can publish a game that's virtually the same thing and you can't do a thing about it. Because they're afraid of getting sued. Now, the copyright law is such that ideas in games cannot be protected. It's different in most other things, but for some reason, game ideas cannot be protected. So in fact, to sue somebody because they used your idea in their game is laughable, but given the way the courts work, it can still cost money to work it out. But you cannot protect ideas in games. That's different from other endeavors. Some of you are old enough to remember George Harrison's song, My Sweet Love, My Sweet Lord. He was sued by the people who owned the rights to He's So Fine, which was a much, much older song by a girl group. He lost that lawsuit and paid because some of the form of his tune was quite unusual and it matched what was used in He's So Fine. If you listen to the two songs, you'd say, nah. But people who understand music very well, including the judge, apparently said, yes, he didn't do this on purpose, but subconsciously he probably borrowed it. Nothing like that can happen in games because you cannot protect ideas in games the same way you can do that in music. Nonetheless, given the way the country works, if you have some money and you want to sue somebody, then the other person has to spend money to defend themselves, and the publishers don't want to have to deal with that, and so many of them have these draconian agreements that you have to sign before they'll even talk to you. And others are quite reasonable, but it depends. They've got to know who you are. If you're Joe Schmo, walk up and they don't know you. If I walk up to them, they know me. If you've had some games published, you can say, you know, I've had such and such published, and then they'll be willing to talk to you. But that's a general problem that you have. If you're not already known, how do you become known? Well, there are various ways to do that. One is to volunteer at the booths, at conventions. That's what Matt Forbeck did. And after they knew who he was, and they knew his work habits, and they knew what sort of fella he was, he said he wanted to write something for him and so on, it worked. Another way is to have articles published. Nowadays, mostly on the web, but there are magazines like Against the Odds that will actually pay for articles. Another thing is to make modifications of games. I designed lots of diplomacy variants way back when. I'm probably still of more diplomacy variants designed than anybody in the world. Which was good practice, and also I got well known. And I wrote lots of articles for Dungeons Magazine and Dragon Magazine, rather, and White Dwarf and things like that about Dungeons and Dragons. So I was a known quantity as opposed to somebody who was just come out of the blue. And that's the kind of thing you have to do. You know, you can always hear stories about people who luck out, but that's very much the exception. The rule is, you have to do something to make yourself known to a publisher before they really have much interest in what you want to say. And this is a great disappointment to young people, because they've been told in school that they're great and special and so on, and when they get to this bit, no, they're not great and special, or they might be, but the publisher doesn't know that. You're just the, you know, go away, kid. That's reality. Now, how much money do you make? Let's see. By the way, if you have questions anytime, just let me know. And if any of you have a ticket to this, I need to collect them at some point. But we'll worry about that after a while. How much money do you make? Well, in my experience, the standard is generally 5% of the revenue of the publisher. Not 5% of what the game sells for. 5% of what the publisher sells it for. That's a big, big difference. So, let's take the example of a $40 game. How much does the publisher sell that game for? The publisher sells it to a distributor at 40%. The distributor adds 10% and sells it to a game shop. The game shop adds 50% and sells it to you. And if you know anything about game shops, that 50% is not exorbitant. They're barely staying in business, most of them. So the publisher's only getting 40% of the price, so they're getting $16 from that $40 game. You get 5% of that. That's 80 cents. Some publishers will subtract their shipping costs from the revenue before they take the 5%, so it'd even be less than 80 cents. So $40 game, 80 cents. Doesn't sound so impressive then, does it? And you know, it's not that different in other forms of creative endeavor. Book publishing, I believe it's 6%, and it may be 6% of the retail rather than the wholesale for a paperback. It's 10% for a hardcover. I think that's of the list price, but I'm not positive. Music, the composer gets 6% or something, I'm not sure of what. But none of these endeavors is it very high. In games, it's pretty low, because the tradition in games comes from the kind of games that were published by Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers and so on, where there wasn't much of a design, and most of the value was in the bits and putting it all together. You know, Hungry Hungry Hippos. How many of you had kids or nieces or somebody who's played that? There's almost no design in that game. So it's not surprising that the manufacturer makes most of the money. Now, when you come to war games, you would think that there's a lot more that the designer puts into it, but the tradition hasn't changed all that much. And there are reasons for that. A lot of times the manufacturers will actually change the games, and they feel that they're adding value to it that way too. A lot of times they screw it up, but they think they're adding value to it. And you can find designers who've had a lot more games published than I have who will tell stories about games they've had published that were screwed up by the publisher.
So, you know, kind of like, you know, script writers, their product, you know, being completely changed, the same thing happens in gaming once you sign that over?
It can. Now, it depends partly on the company. GMT, for example, says they won't change something without the approval of the author. But GMT is peculiar. They're almost a hobby company. Britannia was originally published by H.P. Gibson's in England. And I had already had a game published by Gibson's called Swords and Wizardry. It's kind of Stratego, fantasy Stratego with dice rolling involved. But anyway, they'd screwed it up in one particular respect. They'd changed the rule to be standard to another Stratego-like rules, and it screwed it up a little bit, and the guy admitted he'd screwed it up. So they published Britannia. The same guy took it for 2 years and worked on it, and he changed it considerably. And some things he changed that were just misunderstandings, but resulted in bizarre things. The first time I actually watched somebody play Britannia, which is 18 years after it was published, because for 20 years I had nothing to do with the game industry. I just played D&D. So I watched the game in 2004, and the Jutes were floating out at sea in about the year 1000. Well, the Jutes didn't exist anymore in the year 1000, not even close. That was not the way I wrote the rules, but that's the way it was in the originally published version of the game. So an utterly ridiculous occurrence. But the guy who modified it for Gibson's was not an historian. Or he just didn't care, one or the other. Well, in the new version of Britannia, it was published a couple years ago, I fixed that. I fixed a lot of things. It's more like it should have been to start with. That's typical.
Who published the
Fantasy Flight?
Okay. And they worked with you.
They worked with me, but even there, and I got into the contract that it could not be substantially changed.
Okay.
What happened was they rewrote the rules to the new style, which is I'm going to read the rules and try to play the game at the same time. Sequence of play rules. Now, obviously, I am not a young person. And when I started playing war games, you read the rules through, probably more than once, figured out what was going on, studied the game, and then you played. Now, people take a game, they have no idea about the game, and they get together, and somebody reads the rules, and they try to play as they do it, which really strikes me as a bad idea in Britannia, but nonetheless, Fantasy Flight felt that needed to be done. Well, when you rewrite the rules, you are going to have to test them again. If you make any change in the rules, you have to test it because it's very easy to introduce unintended consequences. They did not test the rules. I wrote to them specifically and said, they were sending me this stuff as a courtesy and I was very busy and they were on a very short deadline for some reason, like a couple week or two. And I said, I can send these rules to some people who know the Britannia rules better than I do, because there are people who do, and they'll probably find more mistakes because I found some. And I didn't get a reply. And what they published then required an errata because it was screwed up in several ways. It was inevitable. That's the kind of thing that happens. You get publishers who feel that they know what they're doing better than any of the designers. You can understand why they feel that way. But then they do things that are obviously stupid. Rewriting rules and not testing them is stupid. There's no way around it.
So I guess as gamers, we assume there's some sort of quality control thing going on before every game.
Oh, yeah. The more you know about any business, the more you wonder how they stay in business. If you know schools, for example, or colleges, you say, my God, is that screwed up? If you know a retail company, my God, how do they stay in business? That's the typical sort of situation. And these companies, even a big one like Fantasy Flight, they're on deadlines, and they've got people who don't have a lot of experience, and they screw up. And that's reality. So when a game comes out and it's messed up, maybe it's the author's fault, but more likely it's the publisher's fault. Now, in addition to all this, And this is something that started with SPI and Jim Dunnigan and so on. And Dunnigan has said, Dunnigan's not here this year, is he? I haven't seen him. Dunnigan said that they were people who were historians designing games, and they were more interested in history than in the game. So the assumption was that the designer would do about 80% of the game, and somebody else had to do the last 20%, which takes the most time to get it to be a good game, and that is the, quote, developer, unquote. That's another person who is hired and paid a lump sum by the manufacturer to do the work. Sometimes they don't change it much. Sometimes they do. GMT will hire a developer, but they say they won't change it unless you agree. So in that sense, the developer is a super playtester. You can understand that historians have only done 80% of the game, may not do the rules very well, and if so, those rules are going to get rewritten. The historian may not playtest the game very well, and it's playtesting that makes a game good. I don't care how good your initial idea is, your initial prototype is not going to be much of a game. It's got to be playtested and playtested and modified and modified and playtested and modified and playtested. I could go on for quite a while. And then you have a chance to get a good game. Well, a developer can do that. But it also means that they can change the game. And see, say Don Greenwood is your developer. How many people here know who Don Greenwood is? Oh my God. Don Greenwood was the principal face of Avalon Hill for like 30 years. Out of college. And he's now the person who runs the WBC and so on. He doesn't design so many games himself, but he develops a lot. So he's developed a vast number of games. And that means he's probably pretty good at it. So if you have somebody who's a designer and hasn't designed all that good a game, and you give it to Don Greenwood, it might turn out to be a good game. So developers, you know, sometimes they'll do good things, sometimes they won't. But you can expect the game to be changed. The only way it won't be changed is if you publish it yourself. But then you're not a designer anymore, you're a publisher, and you've got all kinds of money things to worry about, and you have to decide you want to do that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you seem like you're laying out the case for self-publishing pretty clear right after
that. Number one, you need to be a business person,
sure,
which I'm not sufficiently. Number two, you have to have the money and be willing to lose it, because you probably will. Number three, you become a business person instead of a designer. And Greg Kostikian's written something about that, and I believe there's a reference to that in the slides, if you download the slides. Some of you came in late, there's something that lists where you can get the slides. We can do that in a minute. But a great many games are self-published nowadays. The reason there are so many games out there on the floor is that so many of them are self-published. It's much more practical to self-publish a game now. You have computers to take care of a lot of the work for you that you didn't 25 years ago or 30 years ago. One reason why individual games don't sell very much is because there are so many more games on the market, and one reason why there's so many more games on the market is because it's easy to self-publish. And the result is you get a lot of not very good games, mediocre games. And every year you can come here and you see these little companies have one or two games, and they may or may not be good, but they won't be here next year because they spent more money than they got and it didn't help them enough. Happens all the time. So if you self-publish a game, be prepared to lose almost all the money you're spending. It might not happen that way. You might get really lucky and people will see it and some big company will want to pick it up. Because Hasbro, Matt Forbeck said last year, Hasbro has a guy whose job is to go around the world looking for games for Hasbro to publish that have already been published. Obviously, they don't pick very, very many, because Hasbro's not publishing many board games these days, other than the traditional Risk stuff and Axis and Allies. They don't publish much. They recently republished Diplomacy. It was out of print. I believe History of the World is out of print, and so on. There are a lot of sort of standard Hasbro games that are not in print. So let's go back to royalties. 5% of the company's revenue. If you are fortunate, you might get an advance. And that means they would pay you a lump sum up front. And then the royalties are counted against that lump sum until the royalties are more than the lump sum, and then you'd start getting more money. That's typical in the book publishing industry. It has become possible in the game publishing industry, but it's not necessarily what's going to happen. And it's possible that if they'll offer you an advance, but they'll offer you a lower percentage rate. And then you have to decide. I would always go for the higher percentage rate, although at my age, who knows whether I'll be around to collect it. But you have to decide. So, if you win German Game of the Year and get 250,000 copies published, you might make over $200,000. But there's a lot of big ifs there. You need a telescope to look up to those ifs. War games do not sell very well. Why? Because a lot of people who would have been war gamers are now video game players. And they're not playing board games. A typical print run for somebody like Decision Games, 1,500 or 2,000 copies. Clash of Arms, same sort of thing. GMT goes a bit above that now. They're doing pretty well. When I went to talk to people about getting Britannia reprinted after it had been out of print for 8 years probably, people talked to me about 2,000 or 3,000 copies. And this is a game that probably had at least 30,000 or 40,000 in print. Fantasy Flight originally talked 5,000 copies. In the end, they printed 7,500. Well, those sold out in a year and a half. And they're actually going to reprint it, which is unusual, and have an international edition. But that, again, is a game that is regarded as a classic in some circles. And it was known, and you had a lot of people who liked the game whose old game wore out or something, and they bought the new one. And still, we're talking, ultimately, it'll be over 10,000 copies. But that's really unusual. They came to me one day in March and said, "We got a week to revise the rules." Honest to God, a week. This is March. And I'm not even sure it's this March. I think it was this March. Anyway, but this, they learned something. And I sent them off, and I asked a lot of people, and we revised them, and I hope we did a good job, but I'm not sure, because it was a short fuse. And then nothing happened for a long time. And what's going on there is they're having international editions published. And the way they do that is not like the old days, where if you had a German edition published, as I did of Britannia, the people in Germany actually published it and translated the rules and so on. Now, Fantasy Flight takes orders from different companies in different countries. So say the Dutch want 500 copies and the Germans want 2,000 copies. Well, then those companies will arrange for translations of the rules, and Fantasy Flight will have all those printed at once and then put the foreign versions of the text into those boxes and ship the whole 2,000 to Germany. And the reason for that is then if they're able to print more at one print run, and it's a lot cheaper per copy. So, I was contacted. The only reason I knew this was happening is I was contacted by the German who was translating the rules. You know, if you think that game companies keep in touch, close touch with the designer, forget it. That's not the norm. So I found out the international edition was going to be published because the German translator contacted me, and he had not played Britannia. He's a guy who plays war games and translates war game rules. He didn't understand some of the details of Britannia. And fortunately, he was smart enough to ask me, and I, you know, he got it. But he had the original version of Fantasy Flight rules and not the revision that we did. What? So I sent him the revision. But what, you know, what the? Why do you have the old ones? I don't know. So there's lots of disconnects. And then Fantasy Flight And again, Fantasy Flight's one of the big companies. So, am I picking on Fantasy Flight? Not exactly. Fantasy Flight originally was going to do the reprint in the spring, and I think what has happened, I don't know, is that the translations have taken long enough that they put it back to August now, because they're going to reprint the English edition and do all these foreign editions at the same time. So they have to have all the translations done and get them all typeset and so on, and then have it all printed.
Question about playtesting. Do you have any suggestions or insights as to like how you would find like good playtesting like groups, or like how many groups that you should have, or like how many sets of playtesters you should go through, or how many? Or
I just remembered I should count everybody while I'm thinking of 2, 4, 6, 7. Playtesting can be a big problem. If you're Reiner Knizia, you playtest, I am told, he playtests 6 nights a week. And he has some people who playtested with him for years. He lives in England now. But I haven't got that direct from him. I got it from Alan Moon, maybe. If you live in a big place like Columbus, that's heaven. Because there are a lot of gamers here. I live in a place that's a fairly large metropolitan area, Fayetteville, North Carolina, with a lot of military people, but they don't seem to be game clubs, so I find it hard to find playtesters. I have worked with game clubs at colleges, which I founded, actually, and they would playtest some. I found video gamers are good playtesters many times because they're not so familiar with board games. If they play it and like it, then maybe you really got something. There's a tabletop gamers group in North Carolina State, is Raleigh, but it's 45 miles away from me. So I go there. There's a monthly group that meets at a guy's house. For about 5 years he's done it, so he'd get 25, 30 people. I go there every month, and that's 60 miles. So college game groups are a possibility. There's lots of ways on the internet to get in touch with people, meetup groups, things like that on the internet. But part of it is just chance. The one thing you don't want to do is just rely on your family to playtest things. That's a bad idea. Because they'll probably be nice to you. And you don't want, particularly, the playtesters to be nice to you. You want them to tell you the truth. Well, people, by and large, tend to be polite. We might come back to that. That's more a topic for the other, for 3 o'clock. Yeah. Okay, what about submitting games to the big companies? Forget it. They don't want to know. They have their own people. Why should they pay royalties to an outside designer? They can get their own people to do it, and their own people have a lot of experience. So, unless you're very lucky, you're not going to get Hasbro or those guys to publish a game for you. Just not going to happen. That's reality.
I'm sorry, by big, you're talking Hasbro, or you're talking...
I'm talking about big Hasbro.
Okay, like Fantasy Flight 2, or...
Fantasy Flight generally doesn't take outside submissions. But you never know. But they tend to like to do things in-house. And see, Fantasy Flight is a big marketing company. And they recognize what the market is. And the market right now is big boxes with lots of plastic figures in them. You can sell Tide of Iron $80 and Descent and Dust. And some of these other things. All the games they've been coming out with lately, unless they come out with a Knizia game that's already there, because they'll do his, are big boxes with lots of plastic figures, because they can make money on it. Eagle Games used to do that, but Eagle Games went bust for reasons that had nothing to do, according to them, with their games. What happened was, they made some poker playing software, and they got into it early and sold a lot. So then they put a lot of money into poker playing software, and by that time a lot of people had written public domain poker playing programs, and nobody bought them, and they went bust. pure and simple. But Eagle Games had the notion of big boards and lots of plastic figures and no sell. People want that tactile and visual thing, especially younger people. They're used to the internet and television and so on. You know, I tell my students, I was lucky when I was a kid, I had three stations. They were all black and white. Some people only had two TV stations. Well, now they've got hundreds of them. They can watch TV on the internet. It's just, they're very, very visually oriented. And that comes into games as well.
Are those same games popular in Germany?
Well, the question was, are the same games popular in Germany? The games with the big boxes and the a lot of dice rolling and the plastic figures are often called American games. As opposed to German games.
You used the term earlier, Euro games, and I wasn't sure what you meant.
Euro style, there's a particular style to it, and it's popular in Germany particularly, but it's popular some here. And it involves things like no player elimination, they're usually point games, they're usually games where you don't attack each other. There's a whole list, you know, I have an article online, Games Journal, that lists like 13 characteristics. Yes, they tend to have three-dimensional pieces. There's a lot of great visual interest. I don't remember all the details, but it's a particular kind of game, which is very different from the American games. So I would say in general, no, they're not very popular in Germany.
This might also maybe be a question better for the other seminar. But since the visual aspect is so important, do you have any suggestions or insights as to, like, how would you find somebody who would design like a little wooden or a little plastic piece that would be attractive, or the art that you would put on a game board that would be attractive? Is there an effective way?
Well, remember, the publisher does all that. The designer has almost no influence.
Oh.
Unless you self-publish, you have almost no influence.
So you don't have to worry about lining up your own artists.
No. I've heard of one game where the designer was a commercial artist and did the art as well. It's only one. They don't even want your suggestions generally. They're the guys. They know. They have the experience. They hire professional artists. In the case of Britannia, they didn't want to put words on the pieces because they wanted it to be possible for international publication. And that's very common, universal pieces. So they just wanted pictures. Well, they did some nice little art of figures, but, you know, you can't really tell one from another very well. So I said, you need to put a symbol on the piece, a shield or an axe, something that's fairly obvious. And that's what people use to differentiate the pieces. They don't use the little figures. Because the little figures, they're all figures. They don't look too much the same. So I had some influence there. But I couldn't, for example, say, use plastic figures. It was up to them. And I was happy with what they did. They did a really great job on the art and so on. The Britannia itself is not suitable for plastic figures because you can have really large stacks of pieces and you can't get them into a place with plastic figures. But in general, plastic figures are important, or wood, something that's three-dimensional. Because if you need to move something, three-dimensional is much easier than cardboard. Especially those half-inch cardboard pieces. You know, I grew up with half-inch cardboard pieces, but I'm not playing a game with half-inch cardboard pieces. Especially if there's numbers on them. No way! It's too... And my eyes aren't too bad, but I just don't need that anymore. And that's generally true of a lot of people. They just don't want to deal with that. Now, Clash of Arms, who publishes lots of traditional war games, has had a game of mine, Germania, for 3 years, trying to figure out how to produce three-dimensional pieces, and they haven't succeeded yet. Now, there are sources for three-dimensional pieces, little blocks and so on. If you want something that's very specific, there's a guy who published a game called Victory 2, Victory with a K. He had somebody in Britain model his pieces, which are soldiers and frigates, actually they're ships of the line, and cavalry and artillery. He had somebody in Britain model them. He had somebody in China make them. It took him a year. But they're really nice pieces. So I bought several sets. They're very expensive to use in my prototypes. But I have to suspect he lost a lot of money on it. Self-published the game. There are self-published games with nice plastic pieces, and that's where some of the businessman comes in, you know, whether you pursue things and so on. And if you go to online forums or board game designers group in Yahoo groups, there will be people who will give you advice about where to find that kind of thing for self-publishing. But for having a company publish, you can make suggestions, but they're going to do whatever they decide to do. Because the plastic, for example, plastic pieces, I'm told the mold is like $3,500 each. Well, if you're not publishing thousands upon thousands of copies the way Hasbro does, that's a very, very large fixed cost. It's just not practical. The whole 3D piece business is a larger cost than cardboard pieces. So if a game is being published in a small print run, it's going to very likely have cardboard pieces. It's purely a matter of cost. So forget about the big guys. You know, you never know. Somebody could get lucky someday, but in general, it's just not worth pointing to. Now, if you're inventing toys, there are more companies that publish toys or toy-like games, and there's a whole separate group that does that kind of thing, and it's possible to get in touch with them. Frequently, when you start out there, you use an agent. When you're dealing with the kind of publishers we have here, don't bother with an agent. It's not going to help you. In general, do not ever have an agent who wants money up front. That's a scam. The same with headhunting. If you're looking for a job, don't ever have a headhunter that you have to pay up front. They will get their money. In the case of the agent, they'll get a fraction of whatever you get as you're paid from that game. What that fraction will be, who knows, 10% of what you get, something like that. In the case of a headhunter, they're going to get paid by the company that hires you. But agents generally are not, there's no point. Now, Ravensburger, which is the biggest, I believe, company in Germany, requires you to use an agent. But that's an exception. The bigger a company is, the more likely you are to end up needing an agent. But there are only one big company here, it's Hasbro. Now, having said that, I did use an agent for my first game. I was living in England and doing my doctoral dissertation research, and I knew a guy who owned a game shop and published a game magazine, and I didn't know anything about British publishers, so I relied on him as an agent for my first game, which was Swords and Wizardry, with Gibson's. Gibson's was the big company then. But when I submitted Britannia to them some years later, I just submitted it direct. I didn't go through an agent. Intellectual property rights, we probably need to talk about a little bit. We already have some. Remember, there's copyright, there's trademark, and there's patent. And I'll just say the usual thing. I am not a lawyer, but you can look this stuff up online, and if you don't trust what I have to say. Copyright only protects the words and the pictures. Quite literally, somebody could take a game that has been published, rewrite the rules, redo the graphics, and publish it, and legally, it would be legal. Now, you can still try to sue them, because you can always try to sue somebody, but it would be legal. Now, does anything like that, well, trademark, we'll just go to trademark. Oh, by the way, copyright. The copyright law has changed a lot in my lifetime. Now, if you want to, when you create something, you automatically have the copyright. When you write an email message, you have the copyright. If somebody then publishes that email message, you might be able to sue them. Or a letter, the same thing. Now, if you send a letter to the editor, then obviously they can print the letter.
I'm not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I have done some research, though. If you want to sue for damages, you have to register.
I was about to say that. You're much more likely to be able to sue for damages if you register the copyright, which years ago cost $10. I believe Matt said it's $75 now. You send two copies to the Library of Congress and the $75, and then you registered the copyright. So if you're going to self-publish a game, you need to do that. But if somebody else is publishing your game, you don't need to worry about that. They're going to do that, presumably. And even if they don't, because they have catalogs and so on and so forth, it'll be relatively easy to prove that you did the game first in the court. But in general, in the court, a registered copyright is going to be a lot stronger. The amount of money that we have involved in these things is so small that it's not very practical to go to court. Trademark you can secure, and the trademark would be like trademarking the title of a game. You just put a TM after it when you publish it. It doesn't help to do it before it's published, but when you have a published product, you put TM, and that claims the trademark. Now, you can cough up $350 or something like that and register the trademark, and then you get a little R in a circle. That's a registered trademark. But if you look at games, they are not very often registered trademarks. They're just a TM. And you can have different fields that have the same thing. So Britannia might be trademarked in games, and Britannia is trademarked in something else for a different purpose, and that's legal. And in the movie industry, when somebody spends $100 million to make a movie, they will sue people for things where they don't have a leg to stand on, but they've got enough money to force them to change. It's like, you might have heard this story. There was a guy called Mike Rowe. He made a website called Mike Rowe Soft. And Microsoft, the big aggressive company, told him that he was violating their legal rights and to take it down. Well, what could the guy do? Fight Microsoft, who has billions of dollars in reserve? No. Microsoft didn't have a leg to stand on, but Mike Rowe had to take it down. That's legal reality. If a movie sues you, what are you going to do? There's another case. There was a Scottish company. There was a trash collector, and they were called Eurotrash, and they had a website for Eurotrash.com. They've done this for years. A French company started up, and they called themselves Eurotrash, and they sued the guy to get his website. He won out in WIPO, but it cost him tens of thousands of dollars. You know, and your average person would say, he obviously has it, what's the case? But it still cost tens of thousands of dollars to defend it. And that's reality. And of course, that's not even in this country. It's Scotland and France. That's the way life is. Now, I have read just today, in fact, that there was a court case recently that said that you could use the football players or basketball players and their likenesses for fantasy games and not have to license them. But before that case, it was the case that you had to license them from the league before you could use them. And you'd say, but they're public figures, why is that so? Well, I guess the judge finally decided that, and who knows whether it'll be appealed up the line and so on. Patent. Oh, there's service marks as well. Service marks you usually use to protect a jingle or a motto or something like that, as opposed to a title. I don't know if there are registered service marks or not. Have you looked into that?
Well, anything that you use as trade dress to sell your product can be considered a trademark. I'm not sure. I haven't done any research on service marks. But
service marks are relatively recent thing.
Yeah, the type of box you use, the font, the colors, everything that you do to sell a product that can be protected by trademark. And it helps a lot to have it registered, but it's much more expensive than copyright.
Yeah.
And there you get into, there are secondary trademarks if, you know, you're using something that's already in common usage, like, you know, Kleenex or something like that. But it helps if what you're trying to trademark isn't really directly related to what you're trying to sell. For instance, Apple computers is a very strong trademark because an Apple has nothing to do with computers. If you were to try and sell a computer called computer and trademark computer and then sue everyone else who sells computers, that wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Apple computer and Apple, the label of the Beatles, have had several spitting matches.
They recently settled that.
Yes. Patents are intended to protect a particular expression of an idea. The Frenchman, who was a movie director, who designed the original version of Risk, patented Risk in England. I don't know if he did in this country, but he did in England. However, that game was different from the game that was published in the United States, and I don't know the story about all that. So a patent has to protect a particular expression. In other words, you're supposed to have some kind of product that you patent that uses that idea. Now, the patent office has gone to hell in a handbasket in the past 20 years, and they're letting people patent ideas that have no expression and silly things like, that are obvious. You're not supposed to be able to patent something that's obvious, but there's all kinds of software stuff that's been patented that is obvious, and it's causing big problems in innovation because you can't make something, you can't make software without having to pay royalties to a bunch of people for stupid little patents. You almost never see a game patented, and when you do, it's usually patented by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing and has just spent $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for nothing.
Yeah, the only patent that I'm aware of in games was Richard Garfield for Magic mm-hmm. the Gathering, the tap mechanic, mm-hmm. and the combination of a card game and collectible game, or a collectible product. They patented. I don't know that they've tried to enforce it on anybody, though.
Yeah,
but I know that every other company that makes games that where you turn a card sideways, they don't call it tapping, and that's one of the reasons why.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that if it got tested in court, the court might decide that that's too obvious. And if there's prior art, in other words, it's been done in the past, then that would prevent the patent from being valid. So, certainly from a game designer's point of view, there's no reason to patent anything. And it's just, it'll cost you more to patent it than you can make off the game, by and large. Licensed properties. You may think you have the greatest idea for a Batman game ever, but don't bother unless you can find the people who have the intellectual property rights to Batman games and convince them to let you do it. Because they're the only people who can publish a Batman game. And if you come to them and say, I've designed this Batman game, they're probably going to laugh at you because they have their ideas of what they want to do, which are not what you did. So you'll be wasting your time from the point of view of getting it published. Now, from the point of view of you might enjoy designing a Batman game, you know, that's up to you. But if you have a recognizable intellectual property, then you're wasting your time unless you have a contract with the people who own that intellectual property. So, don't make a NASCAR game. Not unless you've talked to NASCAR. Can make a stock car racing game, because there is stock car racing other than NASCAR, but don't make a NASCAR game. A lot of times, when the intellectual property is something really big, it's not even worth their time to go through the paperwork to sell you the right to make a game for it, because they can't make enough off of it to be worth a while. Literally, it's just not worth it. They want to make a lot of money off it.
Daddy.
Let's see. Let's talk about submitting games. You don't just send your game to somebody. You find what their guidelines are for submissions. Ideally, you talk to them directly. And that's one reason to come here, to talk to people. And in essence, you get permission from them to submit your game. If they have some of these draconian rules, you have to get a submission packet from them and fill it out, and then send them the proposal for the game, or if you really want to, send the whole game, but that's kind of a waste. Send them a proposal. If they like the proposal, then you can send the whole game. And of course, nowadays, if you have PDFs of everything, sometimes you can email the PDFs. And it's possible to make PDFs, you know, if you have Adobe Writer, or if you have later versions of WordPerfect, will write PDFs directly. CorelDRAW will write PDFs directly, and so on. So it's sometimes not so hard to have PDFs. And anybody can print a PDF, and so they can print a copy of your game. You can just send it by email. But that's something to negotiate with the publisher. And then be prepared to wait a long time, and then be prepared to have it rejected. And this is even if you're a person who's known. I have two games that have been sitting with one publisher for the entire past year. I haven't talked to them yet, but I'll bet they still haven't played them. They hadn't as of the end of February. That's the kind of thing that happens.
Do you recommend doing simultaneous submissions? I know some publishers don't like that.
Only if you tell them and they say okay.
Okay.
Honesty is the best policy. I have a motto on my website: always do right. This will gratify some and astonish the rest. Mark Twain. So, tell them up front. I don't see it as unreasonable, because it is common for them to take so long, but some publishers will say, if you're sending to several places, I'm not going to bother. It depends on the publisher. When your game is rejected, I'll say when, maybe if, there can be lots of reasons, and most of them don't have anything to do with whether it's a good game. Most of them have to do with chance, and with what the publisher's looking for at the time, and with what's popular at the time. If you did it 2 years later, or 2 years earlier, you might have got a different response. How many people here have played The Sims, the computer game? It's very, very popular. There was a game called something like Little Computer People that came out a few years before that, that did essentially the same thing. But have you ever heard of it? There was a timing situation there. A really amusing one to me that happened to me yesterday is, last year I brought a game here which I regard as one of my best games, and I've actually had people play test it and partway through say, I'll buy this game. Which is very rare. And I don't ask for that feedback. They just do it. So I said, I'll see if GMT wants to do this. And Andy Lewis looked at it, and he came back the next day, and he said, there's not enough history in it for me to sell it on the P500. It's too Euro-ish. Well, that's the one that's sat in another publisher for a year. But I came this year, and I have a website that lists games that I'm working on, and I said to him that he was interested in some. I said, which ones? And he says, this, this, and this, they're all part of a set. And I said, but you had that one last year. What's changed in the past year? Well, he's found that while it's hard to get the Euro-ish games through the P500, they tend to be some of his best sellers. So in a year, there's been a change in circumstances. Now, whether it'll end up going on there or not, I don't know yet.
What do you mean by the P500?
Oh, P500, some companies, and GMT is the most well-known, because it's kind of a hobby to them, they'll decide to publish a game, they'll make up the rules, they'll make up the artwork, and they'll list it on their P500 list on their website, and it means they want to get 500 pre-orders before they will produce it, because then they know they're going to have enough money that they won't take a bath. And when they deviate from that, they've taken a bath. So they will not deviate from that. As much as it hurts, as much as they're sure it's going to sell well, they will not deviate from that. And what they found is Euro-style games, people want to play them before they buy them. War games, people will tend to order them because of the subject and who the author is and so on. And Euro games, not so much. So this game being a Euro-ish sort of game, there were no dice, there was no chance except event cards and so on. The subject is the Italian Maritime Republics in the era of the Crusades. Well, that's not a real well-known bit of history. And it is a Euro-ish game, so the history is not that strong. He didn't feel last year that there was enough history to be able to get it through the P500, but maybe he's changed his mind. That's the timing bit. And you never know what's going to happen with that. So one of the most important things in publishing is persistence. I don't have as much persistence as I should, and I'm really antsy about submitting games because I'm afraid they'll get screwed up. Because it's happened. If you just want to get it published and you're not too worried about the details of it, then don't worry. And you know, I've heard of authors who have 40 games that they're sending out all over the place. This is mostly German stuff. And I just don't do it enough. Persistence, though, is very important. But I said a lot. There's a lot of luck involved. At PresCon, how many people have been to PresCon? It's in Charlottesville. It's like a miniature World Board Gaming Championship. End of February. Good, nice convention if you like to just play lots of games. Should have worn my PresCon hat. At PresCon this year, I showed an abstract game, and I'm don't normally design abstract games, but I showed it to somebody I knew, and he said, this is pretty good, but he's a very small publisher. He said, let me introduce you to the Mayfair guys. So I showed the Mayfair guys, and we played it some. The first time I played it with the Mayfair guys, one of the guys who played actually quit in the middle of the game, which I have never, ever had happen in a game that was being playtested, ever. He just quit. The reason he quit, he was pissed off at his buddy who was also playing because he wouldn't cooperate. And apparently they have a history. Oh, well. So I didn't worry too much about it. And at the time, he had no pieces on the board. There's not a lot of pieces. Anyway, I took over his position and managed to win the game, which does happen in that game. So there's a case of a lot of chance. First, the chance that somebody actually quit playing. You know, you'd think that'd be the kiss of death. And on the other hand, that I took over and managed to win. The first time you play a game with somebody, all kinds of strange things can happen. And if luck is bad, then it just may not rub them the right way. They may not be happy that day. Something, you know, they may have an argument with their wife. You just don't know. There's an awful lot of chance in the world, and they have a lot of things they have to deal with, and a lot of people bringing them games, and they've only got one shot. And that's another reason to persist. You all know The Lord of the Rings, the book, got rejected a lot of times, apparently. John Creasy, who in his life wrote 600 and some books, mostly mystery novels, was rejected 700 and some times when he started out. But obviously he got better at it. It would have been easy for him to quit, but he didn't. Jerry Purnell, who's a science fiction and fantasy author, says you can become a novelist if you're willing to throw away your first 1,000,000 words, which is about 10 ordinary sized novels. In other words, it's going to take you that long to get good at it. Well, you're not going to start designing games and be boffo, wonderful, really good. It's just not likely to happen in the same way. You're going to have to practice at it. It's very much something you do and you do and you do and you get better at it. If you can practice the way I practiced, which was diplomacy variants, it's less painful perhaps. And D&D stuff I practice with too. In the video game world, we tell people, right, do mods and do levels for games. Because those are things that individuals can do relatively easily. The mods can be pretty difficult. And then you might get the attention of a company. In fact, some of the video game companies, the first people they look for to hire are people who've done mods. They find mods out on the internet that are really good, and they try to find the people and hire them. So there's a lot of persistence involved. Let's see. Now, at 3 o'clock, I will be talking about the process of game design, but I'm going to say a few things here. But before I forget, I'm going to pass this sign-up sheet around. Someday, if I ever get my butt completely in gear, I'm going to write a book about how to design games. If you are interested in finding out if this book comes out, put your email address on this piece of sheet, paper. And if we need more, I have more.
This is minor league marketing.
A very bad idea that's become prevalent, especially because video game design books are very bad about this, is the notion that when you finally get a playable prototype, you are just about done with designing a game. No, you have just started. You've done much of the fun part. The most fun, I would say, is the first few times you play it. And I strongly recommend you play it solitaire. I know of designers who get people together to play a game the first time it's played. I will not inflict that upon people because there are going to be mistakes. I am getting better at it, but there are going to be things that need to be fixed. Well, I should play it and fix them rather than expecting other people to run into them and not have a good experience. I want the playtesters to enjoy playing the game or at least have a decent time playing the game. So I strongly recommend play the game yourself a few times. I played games as much as a dozen times, and of course those are multiplayer games and it takes a long time. It takes a lot of time. And you have to wrap your head around being multiple players, which is interesting too. But you can do it. The least I've playtested a game is 1.5 plays. But that's after a lot of experience. But that's really fascinating. You have this plan in your head, and you know the old saw about the plan doesn't survive first contact with the enemy. Well, first contact with the enemy is playing that game solitaire. You play it solitaire a few times, and sort out a lot of things, and then you have somebody else play it. And that also is really fascinating the first few times other people play it. To me, that's the most fascinating part of game design. But then you've got to look at having people play that game again and again and again, and possibly you playing it again and 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 again, so that you can modify it, so you can tweak it, so that in the end, you're playing that game and you might make one modification in the rules. And I mean a really little modification because the rules aren't clear. Then you're getting close to done. And then who knows what the manufacturer and the developer will do with it. Now, you can just play it a few times, and there's a really well-known designer who used to do that a lot, published lots and lots of war games. Then he depended on the developer to sort it all out. So the developer did the hard work. Well, you can do that. Some companies are happy for you to do that. You have to decide whether that's the way you want to do it.
I'm just curious, at this point, with your solitaire playtest, are you basically just, using pieces of paper and representing?
No, you have to make a map, and you have. I've got vast quantities of cardboard pieces and so on that I've collected over the years. There are educational supply houses online that'll sell you little plastic blocks and so on and so forth at reasonable prices, but you buy 1,000 and things like that. I've bought games to get the little plastic pieces. I bought two sets of Conquest of the Empire pieces yesterday down in the Eagle booth and so on, that kind of thing. So I have lots of pieces. And I used to do the boards. I have vinyl, very thick vinyl, that I bought specially. And wrote on that. I'd get a map on the internet and print it out expanded. Now, I usually skip the vinyl because I'm better at it, and I'll trace the map and just, or I already have a map on CorelDRAW, and so I can put together a prototype pretty quick from experience. And the prototype is perfectly clear, and that's all you need. The one thing you don't need to do is make your prototypes pretty. If you want to, okay. And the pretty can affect how people look at it, but I figure if they like it when it's not pretty, it's just functional, they'll like it even better when it's pretty. I've seen people who produce these beautiful prototypes, and my first thought is, if you put all that effort into making that beautiful prototype, you don't want to change it. And that's what I don't want. I want to be willing to change it. If you're not willing to change it, you've screwed up. And many times I've had a game where I said, gee, I'm playing it, we're playing this, and it's just not getting changed, and I just don't see any major changes. And then, by God, something happens. Something comes up that's a better way to do it, and it gets changed. In effect, the game is never finished. You know, authors of novels would tell you, a novel is never finished. They just finally decide it's not worth the diminishing marginal returns to keep going. And if somebody's a perfectionist, they'll keep going longer than they should. One of my students, who's a brilliant young lady, is an artist, and she's slow as molasses because she's a perfectionist. And she'll make changes and you don't understand why she's doing it. She'll keep working at it. Fundamentally, she lacks confidence. She's only 20 years old. And she has a severe lack of confidence. And that is expressed as a perfectionism, which takes a long time to do things. I mean, there's all kinds of psychology here. The reason I teach is it's interesting to know the people. You can't be a perfectionist. You've got to stop and recognize it's not worth spending more time on this. Because, hell, it'll probably get changed anyway by the manufacturer. But you have to play test it. It's an iterative and incremental process. Now, how many times are you going to play it? Depends on the game. I have a game I showed to a manufacturer yesterday that's only been played 6 times. Now, I still have things to do with it, but I have a lot of confidence in it, and I would say another 10 plays, I'll be in really good shape. Really good shape. I have other games that have been played 30-some times. That's quite common. Now, that's in my presence. That's not counting other people playing it elsewhere. I don't normally play. And there are various reasons for that. One is, if I play, I don't do a very good job of playing, and I don't do a very good job of watching the playtest and seeing what's happening. So I'd rather not play, and then I can concentrate on the playtest. Also, when a designer plays a game, he's a designer, let's gang up on him. Or, he's a designer, he's going to win. Either way, it skews the game. Now, an important thing there is, I don't design games for me, I design games for other people to play. And generally, that's what you should do. But there are people who design games for themselves, and then they don't want to play them all the time. They're not so likely to end up with good games. That's especially true in the video game world, but less so in the board game world. Because if they design games they want to play, it's probably going to be an awful lot like some existing games. My favorite game is Dungeons & Dragons. I have never designed a role-playing game. Because I'm happy enough with Dungeons & Dragons. Old Dungeons & Dragons, not 3rd or 4th edition. I'll say my favorite game used to be D&D. Now it's Britannia, probably. Just from living with it too much. Thank you. 2008 on there. Okay.
So you're present for most of the playtests?
Yes.
You're just observing?
Yes. The ideal is to have it blind tested. In other words, to send the rules, send everything to somebody else who's never played it and have them play. Or give it to somebody.
But you're still there.
No, I'm talking about that. That's a blind test when I'm not there and I can't be involved. Now, a blind test could be people in the next room playing the game and I'm sitting here. But how many people are willing to actually read the rules and play a game? It's much more likely in a play test that I teach people how to play. Then you're not testing the rules. What I do is I have the rules there with me, and I don't write the rules until the game's been played some. I have notes. But I want the game to settle down before I write the rules. That varies over time. I know people who write the rules before they ever play the game. I think that's nuts as far as the efficiency of it, but some people do it. But once I have a settled set of rules, if somebody asks me a question, I look and see if it's in the rules. I don't get it out of here. And people think it's funny, I don't know the rules for my own game. I tell them, you know how many games I've got running? I keep track. In the course of a year, I'll probably have 15 games that are played by other people. And there'll be about 10 that I've played solo. And then there'll be another 15, 20 that I've done something with but not played. I can't keep track of all those rules, and I don't want to keep track of all those rules. So when they play and they ask a question, I see if it's in the rules. If it's not clear, then I fix it. That's not quite as good as blind testing, but it's the next thing. Another thing you can say about playtesting is some people actually have forums and they ask people questions and so on. I go to places where people play games and persuade them to play my game, generally. I have two people, friends of mine, who are willing playtesters and are very, very good at it. One of them used to work as a guy who broke software, you know, find flaws in software. So he's real happy when he makes me write something on the rules. Ha ha ha, we broke Lou's game. That's really great to have. It's really great to have. Because you've got to find those exceptions. So I want people to enjoy the game. And I'm willing to teach them. And I'm not going to try to get them to read the rules and so on, because people just freeze up reading the rules. They freeze up. Especially video game players and Euro gamers. They want somebody to teach them the rules. War gamers are more used to reading the rules and learning on themselves, but not most people. I don't do the questionnaires and so on. How many people have ever heard of Jacob Nielsen? He's the guru of web usability. And you know, most websites are pretty bad, really. They're not very functional. And he tries to teach people simple things about functionality. And one of the things he does when he tests is he watches what people do when they use a website. He doesn't ask him, what would you do if? How do you respond if? Because he finds out what people say they would do, not the same thing as what they do. And I realized the other day, when there's a play test, I'm watching to see what people do. If they're struggling with some rules, I can figure out what they're struggling with and say, this has got to be fixed. If they look like they're having a good time, maybe they're having a good time. If they look like they're bored, maybe they're bored. And I try to figure out from what they're doing what I can do to help the game.
Do you ever videotape a playtest so you can go back and watch later on?
No. I am afraid it would probably make the testers behave unnaturally. And if I can't get it the first time, it's probably not worth looking at it again. Oh, I know that. I mean, you can have a normal video camera and
I mean, they don't have to know. No, what I mean though is just
always do right. This will gratify some and astonish the rest.
No, what I mean though is to capture like what you said, to capture that natural discussion. I've read of people doing that, and what they've found is sometimes somebody will misinterpret a rule, and the whole group will misinterpret. And then they'll play through the whole game with the misinterpretation.
Right. For a blind test, that would be good.
Yeah.
If I'm there, then I provide all that. But for a blind test, that would be good. Yes.
So you're saying that a typical method might be you're there, you're explaining the rules, and you're kind of in the room, and then after you've done that once or twice, then you would write a set of rules, and then you're not there, and then just...
No, I'm there even after the rules have been written, because I am revising the rules as the game goes on. If there's any questions...
And then, well, so when do you do the blind test as opposed to the...
The blind test is the toughest part. Your typical occurrence, if you're sending something to somebody, you send to them, and they don't follow up. This is where people who live in big metropolitan areas with lots of gamers have a big advantage, because they can probably arrange those blind tests. I don't live in an area with enough gamers for the blind test.
So you yourself don't find many opportunities to do blind tests?
No.
Okay.
That's my Achilles heel. And that's another reason why I sit in on so many games, because by keeping my mouth shut and by referring to the rules, I get some of the benefit of blind testing. But the one benefit I don't get is that they don't have to read the rules and figure it out on their own. Now, I'm a big advocate nowadays of the notion that people read so poorly. I mean, a lot of younger people are functionally illiterate because they don't read well enough to know what they read. That you've got to do something else than the rules to get them to understand the game, and that's a video. So I have... Or video or MP3s. You can do that too. So I have an 11-minute podcast about how to play Britannia. And I intend to do a video sometime about how to play Britannia. So that's as close as you can get to being there teaching the people how to play. Well, yeah, YouTube is an obvious thing too. I tried to get Fantasy Flight to put a CD in the game, and they said no. Our clientele is sophisticated enough; they don't need that. And so then I didn't end up doing the video, and I still haven't done it. I have the capability to do it; I just haven't got around to doing it. I videoed Jim Jordan at WBC teaching people how to play, but that's not very satisfactory. Though I may do it again, but you'll notice many of the games put out by guys like Days of Wonder, if you go online, you find a Flash thing that tells you how to play. Flash, that's good too. I think more and more, if you rely on the reader, on the players to learn the game on their own, it's not going to happen. Which is a very sad commentary, but that's seems to be the way it is. And, you know, many groups have one person who reads the rules and teaches everybody else, and they do that again and again and again and again. But there's not always that one person there, is there? A lot of guys are smiling. You're familiar with that situation. I need to talk about contracts, and I skipped right past that. Contracts are always negotiable. Do you need to have a lawyer look at the contract? One, you probably won't know a lawyer or be able to find a lawyer who's got a clue about game contracts. Matt Forbeck's father is a lawyer, and so he's got a lot of lawyerly advice. But we don't all have that advantage, free lawyerly advice. I have never had a lawyer look at one of my contracts because you'd spend all your money, all the money you're going to make, you know, it's just not worth it. But you can be smart. If you read something in the contract that doesn't make sense, then it needs to be fixed. If you don't understand it, you need to fix it. A contract is there mostly for when things go wrong. You know, You may be feeling great about the publisher, and yeah, we're great buddies and so on and so forth, but things can go wrong, and that's what you want in the contract. So, for example, you definitely want something in the contract that says after a certain amount of time, if they haven't published the game, it reverts to you. Now, if you've been paid in advance, then they've got money tied up, and they're a lot more likely to do something about it. Nonetheless, you should still have something like that in the contract. Another thing that should be in the contract is what happens when the game goes out of print. You don't want to sell your rights in perpetuity. So my contract with H.P. Gibson said after it was gone out of print for a year, the rights reverted to me. Well, they licensed it to Avalon Hill. Well, when Hasbro bought Avalon Hill, Hasbro didn't know what they had, and at one point it was reported that the rights to print Britannia had gone to Multiman Publishing. Well, they didn't have a clue, because once it went out of print, the rights reverted to me. And an unusual thing about the Avalon Hill version of Britannia is it's copyrighted in my name, if you look at the back of the box, because it was licensed from England. Most games are not copyrighted in your name, just like a lot of books are not copyrighted in the author's name. A lot of them are. So you need to have those things in there about what goes wrong. You also need to have things about derivatives. What's a derivative? Is a derivative of a game another game that uses some of the same methods? Not normally, but you better make that clear in the contract. And I've had this experience very interestingly. When Britannia was published by Fantasy Flight, I specifically told Christian Peterson, and I've never met him, we negotiated this on email. I specifically told him when I saw the clause about derivatives that I didn't want to be limited to publishing other games that use the Britannia methods, since a lot of other people have done it anyway. And we negotiated something to that purpose. And then after the damn game was published, at least three people at Fantasy Flight told other people that they couldn't publish a game that used Britannia methods. They even told me that. And if you don't think I was pissed off, because they don't even know the law. You can't own those methods. But this is like what the movies do. They pretend they have rights to do something, and if they tell enough people they do and convince them that they do, then by God, I guess they got them. So I've had a thing on my website for a year and a half probably that explains copyright law and says specifically you can't own Britannia. You can't own the history. You can't own the methods that are used in the game. Even though I negotiated in the contract, the crap came out afterwards. And it was crap. So derivatives normally would be things like a digital version of the game. And the manufacturer will want to have the bulk of those rights, because they'll say, well, if I hadn't published the game, it never would have been picked up for digital. In the case of Britannia, since the game had been around for 20 years, I could negotiate it to a different level. But these are the kinds of things you've got to consider. You know, the New York Times got in a lot of trouble because they started to publish things on the web that had been in the newspaper, and the people who wrote the things for the newspaper had not given them the rights to do that. And they finally had to take all that stuff down, because that's electronic rights. So there's a lot of questions coming up because of computers that didn't come up before.
That's come up also with Dragon Magazine and their archive CD. Back then, no one knew about electronic rights. But when they do pay for that, one of the rights that they do have is reprint rights. And
They
came up with the CD.
Well, I used to write a lot of articles for Dragon, and I stopped when they started the policy of requiring you to sell all rights to them. And to this day, well, until they went back to the web, their policy was still for Paizo, because Wizards of the Coast said so, to buy all rights, and I wouldn't write for them. But the articles that were published and have been in Best of Dragon, I sold them First World Serial rights, and so I don't believe they had the right to put him in there. But that's the kind of thing that happens. I haven't bothered to do anything about it.
Science fiction fantasy writers went after Dragon Magazine over that issue.
I hadn't heard that.
Well, yeah, there were other authors who were rather upset.
Mm-hmm.
They told them first, publishing rights, but not necessarily reprint or...
Well, certainly when they buy all the rights, they can do whatever they want with it.
So I'm not sure how they settled that.
Yeah, I would not personally sell all rights to anything unless I got a vast amount of money. Matt Forbeck sold rights to one of his games because he got so much money, he was perfectly happy. I don't know how much money that was, but it was a lot of money.
If you're doing freelance work for RPGs, it's a little different. Most of the people break in and they do work for hire.
Right, and that's one reason why there's so much dreck in RPGs.
Yeah.
If you got so many fanboys that are willing to work for 2 cents a word and sell all the rights, that now, instead of getting royalties, people just get paid a lump sum, and I won't do that.
I was wondering if you had any sample contracts on like one of your websites.
No. It's an idea, but technically the contract may be copyrighted by the company. So maybe I shouldn't do that.
That's an internal business practice. The company probably would not want that on that. But the company that says, can you provide a template or something that gives them an idea of what the contract is? But yeah, the company, like Fantasy Flight Games, would have to release that publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Tom Jolly's got one online.
Well, if he wrote one himself, then that's all right. But if he's taken one that's another company's, then he's probably violating the copyright. And you have to be aware of those things. There's a lot more you have to be aware of. It's a lot easier to publish things now. Let's see, contracts.
You mentioned the contracts of, you know, the Reaper. They pay you a lump sum up front, and then they don't end up publishing the game. The rights revert back to you. What time period would you recommend people shoot for? A year? 2 years?
A year is what jumps to mind. It takes a long time. This stuff takes a long time. Britannia existed in a playable form in 1980. It didn't get published till 1986. When I decided to revise it, from that point, it was 3 years before it was published. Things take a long time. When I talked to Mayfair about something, one of them said, it's a good thing you're immortal because it takes a really long time to get this stuff done. So, it's always going to be years. If you try to cut it too tight, the publisher is going to say, oh, I can't guarantee that. I just can't do that. But that's where you negotiate. If it's always true in a negotiation that the ultimate strength is if you can walk away. If you look at a car and you fall in love with that car, you're not going to be able to negotiate. You're going to buy that car for something close to the list price. If you can walk away, then you can get it a lot cheaper, generally speaking. And the same is true in a contract. If you have the ability to walk away and that's going to hurt them, then they're more likely to cooperate with you. Now, what you don't ever want to do, of course, is be negotiating with two companies at once. Submitting to two at once is one thing. Negotiating with two at once, you better tell them and they'll probably not like it. Well, and on the other hand, there have been cases where, say, someone has their life story to sell, or they have participated in some event that's really important and they're going to write a book about it. They'll have an auction. Literally. They'll say, everybody come a certain day and we're going to see who's going to pay me the most for these rights. And then everybody knows what's happening, but that's what happens. But negotiating with two companies at once to actually publish is probably not a good idea, not a good practice. Unless they know that that's what's happening, and then they'll do whatever they decide to do. It's a small industry. People know each other. The word kind of gets around. I mean, it is possible to get screwed. Matt Forbeck knew of somebody who submitted a wrestling game to a company, and they rejected it, and then they published one just like it. I don't know, but by that time he'd given it to another company who'd published it, and so they were happy to sue the first company, and now they get royalties from that first game. And I had a friend who designed the game, which was published in like a little magazine I used to do 30 years ago, and another game came out that was quite a bit like it. Nothing we could do about it. You can design a game for a particular purpose, and somebody says, oh, that was simple, I'll just design one kind of like it.
Right.
And that may have happened to me, I don't know yet. There's a website of a toy inventor. He writes software, specific software. And he has several stories of cases where he showed something and then they rejected it, and later they did exactly the same thing because the software is not that hard to write. There's really not anything you can do about it. So you want to be a little careful, but the people who are paranoid, and you can spot the novices 100 miles away. They want to spend a lot of money making a prototype for a game they've never played. Duh. Spending a lot of money for making a prototype, period, doesn't make sense unless you're trying to sell to a toy manufacturer. They're very secretive because they're afraid somebody's going to steal their idea. Well, people don't steal ideas generally because they ain't worth stealing. So most people are happy to talk about their ideas, and they gain more than they lose, because two heads are better than one, three heads are better than two. So I like to pick people's brains, and playtesters sometimes can be people you pick their brains. You can say, wow, this isn't working very well, what would you do about it? And some of the really good playtesters, a couple of my friends, they'll think of things. And they know I'm picking their brains.
You had said that, like, you had sent a sheet around that you were hoping to write a book on game design. Are there any books or sources that are already in print that you might recommend?
I think I have a list at the end of the slides if you download them.
Oh.
The game design books are all about video game design, and they spend a great deal of time talking about the planning. Because in video games, usually you have to convince somebody to pay you to develop the game. And so you have to have a really detailed plan. Then you have to have a really, really detailed plan so the programmers can program it. And the result is the video game books concentrate on the first part and ignore the fact that where the rubber hits the road is the playtesting and the modifying, the playtesting and the modifying. Also, your typical result when you read one of these books is you get done and you say, okay, but what do I do? How do I go about it? That's what I'm going to talk about at 3 o'clock. I have a diagram, even a data flow diagram, of what you do and how I keep track of things and what programs I use and that kind of thing. So no such book exists, to my knowledge. It's an interesting commentary on books.
Along the same lines there, one of the things that I saw, I think it was on Steve Jackson's site, was talking about a good thing to do in preparation for learning how to design games is take courses in journalism or law, learn how laws are written, because rules for games may be written in a similar way. What do you recommend?
I would have said a technical writing course would be much more effective than law. Because technical writing tends to be, if you screw up the writing, people don't do right what they're supposed to be doing. So I think of rules writing as like technical writing.
Are there any other types of courses, though, that you'd recommend that somebody take? Or other skills that somebody develop?
If you're interested in historical stuff, historical courses might be good. If you go online at Sloperama, Tom Sloper's website, and he's talking mainly to video gamers, but other people as well will tell you somebody who designs games needs a really broad education. Designing games depends a lot on life experience. He has a list of books to read that are all over the place, and you'd say, what does that have to do with game design? It has to do with sort of expanding your horizons. And, I'll talk at, I've run out of time, I'll talk at 3 o'clock about where you get ideas and so on. And I'll answer any more questions.
Are there any good books on self-publishing?
Self-publishing. There's a thread on ConsimWorld about publishing that Steve Rawlings does, who does Against the Odds and so on. That would be good to read. There's lots of advice in Board Game Designers Forum and which is bgdf.com, I think. And also, you might find some on Board Game Geek, and you might find some in the Yahoo group Board Game Design.
Just on the same conversation, this happens to be the next one, the next talk at 11 o'clock at 2:23. It's an RPG deal, but it's how to self-publish.
Yeah, RPGs you can self-publish with PDFs and sell the PDFs. And there is a book about self-publishing PDFs for RPGs.
I can't make it 3 o'clock, but you have the slide in the same spot.
Yes, yes. And, yeah. Any other questions?
Do you know of any companies that have you ever heard of somebody doing a meeting halfway with a self-publisher?